You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Set List, we'll hear from the Eau Claire band Kalispell. They stop by the WPR studios to play songs and talk about life on the road.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. On Wednesday, a memo from the nonpartisan Legislative Fiscal Bureau revealed an almost $1 billion shortfall in transportation funding in the next budget cycle if nothing changes. State Representative John Nygren requested the memo and is looking for changes in the way transportation is funded in Wisconsin.
Robert Menser joins us now to recap that and other top stories from around the state this week. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks. And can I say, it is great to be back.
Yeah, we gave you a couple of weeks off to go out about your business, I think, but it's good to have you back. Now, before we get to that transportation funding story, want to check in on what's going on in northern Wisconsin. FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, they were up north here in the state looking at the damage from that big storm with flooding, and then there was a follow-up storm. What's the latest up there?
Sure. This is a continuing fallout from the massive flooding earlier in the month, heavy storms July 11th, and we saw, dramatic images, washed out highways, totally destroyed bridges up there. It was bad. So there is an estimate from the Wisconsin Emergency Operations Center that said the storms did more than $28.8 million in damage to public infrastructure in a number of northern Wisconsin counties, another about $1.8 million in damage to private property. So the governor declared a state of emergency. The state is, taking steps to get federal aid to assist in rebuilding, and the first step of that is to have FEMA come. They are here. They're doing the surveys in these northern counties. They will verify damages and come up with their own estimates, and that will allow Wisconsin to move forward in requesting federal aid.
So if they say we're eligible for federal relief, that's a pretty big difference maker, isn't it?
It's a huge difference. When you think about it, we're talking about Ashland County or Sawyer County. These are not counties that have a lot of slack in their budgets to take up something massive like this. The state will have until August 10th to apply for a federal disaster declaration. FEMA has said that Governor Scott Walker will get its final report within the next 2 weeks, and then he can decide whether to make that application.
Let's move on to this story about roads and transportation funding in Wisconsin. There's a lot of backstory here. This was a big issue in the last state budget. Ultimately, had to be taken, I think, out of the budget to get resolved. Now, this week, we've heard Legislative Fiscal Bureau comes out with a report requested by State Representative John Nygren, Republican from Marionette, influential in the legislature. What's he looking for? What's he talking about? Why is he bringing up this issue now?
Yeah, a lot of backstory. There's decades of backstory to it, right? This transportation funding has been one of the livest issues in the state, and it's one that it's interesting because it really doesn't divide along partisan lines in the way that we might be accustomed to. And so, John Nygren, powerful Republican budget committee guy, has officially in a memo this week said that Governor Scott Walker should consider various ways of raising revenue, including raising the gas tax, including instituting a system of toll roads in Wisconsin, which has been, verboten for decades. And the reason is because what we have now, the system that we have now, is not sufficient to maintain and in some cases expand the state's infrastructure of roads. That shortfall represents not just, some big highway expansion projects that are already on hold, but also like all the transportation money that goes down to local government units that takes care of local roads, county roads, and so on. It's all deteriorating over time, right? You get potholes in these roads over time. And there have been national surveys that found Wisconsin's roads are in among the worst condition in the nation. There was at least one survey that found it as the third worst. And so it's something that there's a lot of appetite or a lot of legislators saying that we got to, the state needs to deal with this. And the way to do that is with revenue.
I want to bring up Representative Nygren. Rob, he had a call with reporters on Wednesday. Here's a listen.
It's not necessarily the fiscally conservative position to simply say no and to continue to delay projects and delay growth of our system and capacity in our transportation system that's going to drive our economy.
And the case kind of being made is that Governor Walker is saying no. Now, I noticed on Twitter there was a stretch where Representative Nygren and Governor Walker were both tweeting. It wasn't exactly a Twitter beef. We weren't in Kanye and Taylor Swift territory here, but they were each, Governor Walker was saying, hey, we've got good roads. We've got good spending on roads here in Wisconsin. Representative Nygren saying no, pulling up other stats. Not really tweeting at each other, but parallel arguing on Twitter.
Subtweeting.
Yeah.
Subtweeting.
Exactly.
Yeah, totally. Right. And I mean, Walker's position throughout all of this has been that the state shouldn't raise taxes. It shouldn't raise fees for this stuff. He, in the last budget, proposed to deal with it through bonding, that is borrowing the money to the tune of multi-billion dollars, and that is something that some of the more fiscally conservative minded Republicans that was the cause of the battle in the last state budget. Walker is now advocating for more or less keeping things as they are, and he's put forward a sort of a bare bones maintenance plan that would avoid new taxes, but that the argument goes wouldn't actually address the problems with the roads.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network, Wisconsin, looking at some of the big stories of the week in Wisconsin. One more to get into: a reporter, Rob, ejected from a rally for Indiana Governor, now Republican vice presidential candidate Mike Pence, earlier this week. Briefly, what happened?
Yeah, so it was Mike Pence's first solo campaign event since he joined Donald Trump's campaign. He's in Waukesha, and it's significant that the event was at a public building. It was the Waukesha County Exposition Center. So this reporter tried to show up and go through the media line. He was told that he was barred from covering it, so he went in through the front door that any other member of the public would go in, and he was told that he couldn't bring his cell phone, couldn't bring his laptop in. So he went and put those in his car, came back, and then still was told that he couldn't enter, and was even detained and patted down by members of the Waukesha County Sheriff's Department, which is, a lot of people have raised that as an outrage, and it is kind of hard to imagine, right? There's no accusation that he was breaking a law, that he was in any way a security risk. He was just trying to go and cover this event.
Briefly, Rob, any word from the Waukesha Sheriff's Department or government there about their response to that?
Sheriff's Department stands behind its deputies. They said that they were following normal protocols and responding to security requests from the Trump campaign. So I guess they are like an arm of the Trump campaign now. It seems weird to me, but I'm a member of the media, so I guess I'm biased on this.
Well, I think Trump and the media, the transportation budget, will probably come back to these in the future, Rob. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great. Thank you.
That was Robert Mentzer. He's a storytelling editor for USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau, and he joins us every week to look at the top news stories from around the state.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk about the pros and cons of having police officers in schools as the Madison Public School District takes a closer look at its current policy.
First, we continue our summer music series, Setlist. We invited artists from all over the Midwest into the WPR studios for interviews and exclusive musical performances that air every Friday at this time until Labor Day weekend.
Today we feature the Eau Claire band Kalispell, who recently stopped by our studio to play songs from the latest album, Printer's Son, and talk about navigating the continual tension between the love of making music and the wear and tear of being on the road playing that music.
Shane, thanks so much, and welcome to the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for playing live for us today.
It's a thrill to be here. Thanks for having us.
So you started out with a song called Gary, Indiana. Can you tell us a little bit about that song and where it came from?
Sure. I was living around the Milwaukee area, well, Chicago and then Milwaukee. And so any time that I headed out on tour, which was often, like monthly. It started with a drive through Gary. And I know that I am no ancient explorer. Smoke signals black, rising slow. I'm driving across my own ancient America, jotting down words as I go. And, you know, it's not one of the most aesthetically pleasing places in the world, unless you're really into, like, Mordor imagery. And I apologize to the residents of Gary for saying that. But so I was driving through it, and I don't know, I was thinking about how I was away from friends at home and people I loved at home a lot. And I was thinking about how I don't write many songs for people in my life. And I thought that I could do that, but they would probably just appreciate me being home more often, you know, like in exchange.
So it's a guilty road trip song?
Yeah, it's like an anti-love song in a way, but it's not, I mean, it's not that cynical. It's just, that's what I was thinking about when I wrote the song.
You did have a line about getting rid of the nostalgia for the road, that there's not so romantic, it sounds like, once you're actually out there driving through Gary, Indiana.
It's up and down, you know? The first times that you go out, everything is exciting and beautiful, even though you're in someone's, like, damp, crumbling basement playing for 10 people. It still feels magical and special, and it is. But, you know, as you do it more and more, part of that wears off. Because you have these friendships and these bonds that you form with people when you're on the road. But over time, I feel like I've come to realize that the part of their lives that you're getting to know is like only their weekends or only like their evening when they're out having fun. And in a way, those friendships, if you put too much onus on them, can start to feel empty. So yeah, the song is about, you know, the tension of like wanting to do that and loving playing music and loving touring, but also having this meta-awareness that it's not necessarily 100% sustainable from, like, a spirit perspective.
So did you decide to start staying at home more, stop touring so much after you wrote this? Or is it just one of those moments, now you're aware of it, but you got to do what you got to do because you're a musician?
I'm probably away even more since I wrote that, which I'm thankful for because I get to work with a lot of really wonderful people. The idea is to tour smarter, not necessarily harder. I mean, I love playing shows, but that's like 5% of your day when you're on tour. And the other 95% is usually you're looking through a windshield at the world.
Get over the romance of long distance travel, the sentiments still to recite. Like a late evening gush of ecstatic discussion, Neil Cassidy already tried.
You've been playing from Printer Sun, and I wonder if you'd tell us about where this album came from for you.
It mostly came from reflecting on my connection with my immediate family. And so a lot of the songs on the record are about my relationship with my dad. He's one of the people who inspired me and taught me most in my life. But we also had these stark political and social contrasts. It became sort of ironic in a difficult way because after the songs were written, he kind of suddenly passed. He was diagnosed with cancer and passed less than a year later. Mm-hmm. So singing the songs and thinking about the record now is very different to me than when I wrote the songs.
I'm sorry to hear about your dad, and I know that you write about that. You not only lost your father, it sounds like you also lost your grandfather at that time. There might have been even more areas of loss and transition in there. So how would you said it's different now. How does this album feel to you as a memento of those relationships and that love?
Yeah, it was an intense 2 years or so of change. Yeah, losing my dad, and then shortly after going to visit his dad, my grandfather, on his deathbed and talking to him. And, you know, we also lost our family dog a couple months ago, which seems like a contrite country song, you know, but it's true. And also at the same time, I was leaving a relationship that I had been in, you know, a long time. The person who was very supportive and intelligent and kind, but a relationship that had run its course. And so it was scary going through all that change, but it produced outcomes that I never would have expected. Like, I think now I love and appreciate my dad more than I ever did, you know, unfortunately, when we were around each other. I think it works that way for a lot of people when they lose someone. But immediately following all that, I unexpectedly also met, you know, this woman who's an incredible, beautiful, insightful person who I married. And now we have a daughter together.
I met her.
Yeah.
she's beautiful.
Right, she's right over there. So I am looking at, like, Shane 2 years ago. I'm in a totally different place. It's wild to me. I wonder where I'll be in another 2 years. I wouldn't mind if it was slightly more predictable for the next couple of years.
And on the day of a wedding, beside the lake, or rather the same place, 2 years too late. And I'm parked by the wayside, we dropped you off. I was breathing the thinning air, ditch weed and lost.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the influences on your music. And I read on your bio, again on your website, that you have an interest in folk melodies. You have an interest in improvisation, kind of from the jazz world, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
Formal composition, you've worked with gamelan ensembles, you've studied banjo traditions in Appalachia. How does that all come together and get synthesized in your music?
I'm glad that you mentioned the gamelan music. I think a lot of times people don't mention that because they're not sure what it is.
I didn't hear a gamelan here today, but I know it's got to influence you somehow.
Yeah. I try to be open to as much as I can. I grew up playing jazz music and, you know, my teacher was a jazz musician, and so I didn't really choose it. It kind of came to me. And, you know, then I figured that I should go to college for music before I realized that to be a professional musician, you just have to keep practicing. You don't have to have a diploma that says musician on it. So I tried to study classical music more seriously in college, more out of, like, guilt than anything else, because I felt like I should get my comeuppance and do that. And it didn't stick, you know, so I studied English instead in college. But the classical music was in there. And after that, I moved out to Boston and ended up playing with this wild gamelan that it was like traditional Balinese music, but they also had robots that were built at MIT that, like, played themselves as instruments. And
wow.
And then also, like, during college, I met all of these old-time musicians who played old-time fiddle and banjo who inspired me to spend serious amounts of time in, like, West Virginia and Kentucky and Tennessee. I think I'm just always trying to figure out how to synthesize them in as seamless a way as possible.
And suddenly lived a girl Irene, soft brown hair, her features plain, to her lover Jane she'd often call and asked to be his beautiful doll.
Well, I think I heard that in your song Beautiful Doll. How do you hear that one coming together?
Well, the guts of that tune are an old banjo tune called Beautiful Doll. But at the same time that I was learning that tune at a wonderful place in West Virginia called the Augusta Heritage Center, I was also listening to a lot of Philip Glass. And it just made its way together in my brain and came out in this kind of cascading way. So I kind of feel like the first half of that has a more traditional clawhammer banjo sound, and then it goes into this almost Reichian kind of, like, minimalist phase piece.
Yeah,
at the end.
It does. we wrap up, I know you're from Eau Claire, and Eau Claire has become almost this musica mecca these days. Thanks in part to Justin Verdon, thanks to a lot of a creative community that sort of just seems to infuse Eau Claire, too.
Yeah.
Do you think there's something special about what's going on in Eau Claire, and what do you think it is?
Yeah, I really believe that it's extremely special. And I think for a lot of us who like went to college there or grew up there, there's been a complicated relationship with it. It's weird to have the peers who immediately surround you all of a sudden like take off on these cosmic paths, you know? Like the things that Justin's doing now and that he's able to make happen are wild, like on a global scale with all different kinds of artists. And so there's a complicated relationship of like being thankful for that and being inspired by it. But then the question is like, well, who am I and what am I doing? And I don't, you know, it's like, what's my place in all that? But I think the thing that is special about Eau Claire, to more directly answer your question, is that it's big enough that there's always interesting things going on and there's a real groundswell of creativity, but it's still a small town in most people's minds, you know, which is nice. I hope that it stays that way, but continues to just quietly be incredible.
Well, you guys were fantastic. Thank you so much, Shane, for coming in and playing today.
Thanks for having us.
That was the Eau Claire band Kalispell. You can catch them performing live August 4th at the Sounds Like Summer concert series in Eau Claire.
Coming up, a Wisconsin school district is reconsidering having police officers in high schools. A guest looks at the arguments and data surrounding the issue. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's The Political Junkie with Ken Root. Ken and his guests look at the high and low points of this week's Democratic National Convention.
First, a Wisconsin school board is reconsidering its decision to have police officers in schools. The Madison Metropolitan School District has a 3-year contract with the city's police department to have police officers in some high schools.
There have been, though, some cases that have caused parents and board members to question whether officers are using too much force on students. That includes the mother of an autistic high school girl who told the Capital Times that her daughter was arrested by a school police officer when she should have been helped with the anxiety she was having over attending a class.
Police officers in schools are also known as school resource officers, or SROs, and the Madison School District is part of a larger national conversation about the role SROs should have in schools. Last October, a Justice Department investigation was launched after a viral video showed an African-American high school girl being violently arrested by a school police officer in South Carolina.
Joining us now to tell us more about some of the arguments around police officers in schools is Jason Nantz. He's an associate professor of law and associate director of the Center on Children and Families at the University of Florida Levin College of Law. He's written about this issue. Jason, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you very much. I'm happy to be on the program.
First of all, how common is it for schools to have a police officer, one of these school resource officers, on the premises?
I think it's becoming more common. And so the first police officer that was permanently assigned to a school was in the 1950s. That happened to be in Flint, Michigan. And since that time, we've seen a dramatic increase in the number of police officers that are assigned to schools. In the late 1970s, there were probably fewer than 100 in police or in public schools. And we have data that suggests that in 1997, that number increased to around 12,300. In 2003, it increased even further to 19,900. And it's not clear exactly how many police officers are in school at the moment, but the U.S. Department of Education's National Center for Education Statistics estimates that there could be as many as 30,000 SROs in the year of 2013 or 2014.
What was the original purpose behind stationing police officers in a school?
I think that the original purpose was probably to provide a more of a proactive approach to crime on school grounds. And so probably there to prevent crime and also to establish positive relations among members of the school community.
I want to look at the pro and con arguments here. People point to these SROs, these school resource officers, on the upside and say they make schools safer. There are cases maybe where they've prevented an act of violence. A gun is reported in possession of a student. They're able to intervene quickly. What kind of positives do you see out there when it comes to these officers in schools?
Yeah, so Rob, I think that you mentioned a couple of those. And so one argument that is commonly made is that it does, having school resource officers makes campuses safer. However, there are some questions about that. And so for example, there's a recent congressional research report that, after reading the evidence, says that it draws conflicting evidence about whether these SRO programs actually make schools safer. So it's not very clear. There's not very good evidence to suggest that it does, you know, that having these SROs makes schools safer. So we have that argument, of course. And then the other argument would be is that it does, at least the proponents would argue, that having SROs would increase or build positive relations among the students. And so, as we know, trust right now is particularly strained between police and certain members of the community, especially those of the minority race. And the hope is that by having SROs and having an active presence on campus, and as they act positively with these students, that perhaps that will carry over as children become adults. So those are some of the positives, I think, that people suggest.
I'm talking to Jason Nance from the University of Florida School of Law, looking at police in classrooms, police in public schools. And let's look at what people are pointing to, Jason, as a downside here. One worry that something that used to be maybe a disciplinary incident, a fight in school, a theft in school, now might be more likely to become a criminal experience, a justice system experience for a kid.
Yeah, there's several negatives that people have suggested, and the one that you pointed out, Rob, is probably the largest, is that it contributes to this criminalization of school discipline, or frequently referred to as the a trend we're seeing now, which is the school-to-prison pipeline. And when we use that term school-to-prison pipeline, that suggests this interaction between schools and law enforcement and what schools do directly to influence or put students on a pathway from school to prison, either directly by referring them to law enforcement or indirectly by suspending them or expelling them. And so the worry right now is that by having more police officers in schools is that you end up involving more students, or more students become involved in the justice system. Now, I do have a recent study that will be published very soon by the Washington University Law Review, in which I examine this very question. And so the name of the study is called Students, Police, and the School-to-Prison Pipeline. It's on the SSRN network, and I took a look at restricted data from the U.S. Department of Education's School Survey on Crime and Safety, and I looked at data from 2009 and 2010, which was the most complete database that I had access to that I could examine the effect of having school resource officers in the schools and what that does to students. And what I did is I took a look at the number of incidents or the probability of a school referring a student to law enforcement for committing certain offenses such as fights with or without a weapon, threats with or without a weapon, vandalism, theft, and things like that. And I found that even after controlling for other variables, other things that might influence a school's decision to refer someone to law enforcement or having an SRO on campus, which would include things like the overall level of school crime, school disorder, meaning the overall school disciplinary problems the school faces. I looked at things like school level, urbanicity, student demographics, and what I found was that even after controlling or taking into account all these other variables, I found that once an SRO has a weekly presence at the school or regular contact with the school, that it is much more likely that students will be referred to law enforcement, even for these higher level offenses, but also for these lower level offenses, such as a threat without a weapon or something like that, or vandalism. And that can be problematic.
some people might hear that and say, well, good, we're nipping this problem in the bud. We're bringing this to a higher level right away. That hopefully will lead that student to not repeat that action if it's brought in some police involvement. It sounds like you wouldn't buy that argument.
Well, you know, I think that there's many different ways to think about this. And I think that, first of all, we need to hold students accountable for what they do. There's no question about that. Maybe I'll circle back to that in just a minute. But we also have to realize, I guess a couple of things. One, which is the detrimental impact that incarcerating a student has on the life of the student. And so, first of all, when you detain a student, it's very expensive. So it can cost, the average cost of detaining a juvenile for a year is about $150,000, which is well below the average cost, by the way, of that schools use to educate children per year. And it can range as high as $350,000 in the state of New York.
I'm going to stop you. You said well below the cost of educating a student?
Well, sure. I mean, so I think the average cost of educating a student, or at least the average amount of money per student that the government provides, is around between $7,000 and $8,000 per year. And yet it costs around $150,000 to detain a student per year. So there's a big discrepancy there. And then once you incarcerate a student, it doesn't have a very good effect on that student. And so it affects their future housing opportunities, employment, military, education opportunities. It reinforces violent behaviors. They suffer from mental health problems. And here's, I think, very important, too, is that it doesn't serve as an adequate deterrent. And so once this we're learning from empirical research that once a student is incarcerated, that the rate of recidivism is very high. In other words, it increases his or her involvement in the justice system in the future. Also less likely to graduate. So there's all of these problems associated with detaining a student. And then the second part is, and here's a question that many have, is what type of an environment is that creating in the school itself? And some people think that by removing a student, you are creating a safer environment. But there is research to suggest that when you have an overall punitive environment in the school, that also affects the students who are uninvolved in those types of incidents as well. And so it creates some type of a climate that doesn't attract, for example, good teachers to teach there, doesn't attract middle-class students to learn there, and it creates an overall environment that depresses student learning. So these are things to think about.
We're talking to Jason Nance. He's an associate professor of law at the University of Florida College of Law, looking at the pros and cons of having school police officers, school resource officers, or SROs, as they're often called, prompted in part by the Madison School Board reconsidering its current policy, having officers in many high schools.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. Do you or your family members go to a school with police officers? Does it make you feel safer, or do you worry that it could cause more problems than it solves? Call us at 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Do you have experience working in or attending a school that has a police officer on the premises? Call us at 800-642-1234.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation now with law professor Jason Nance from the University of Florida, looking at the pros and cons of police officers in high schools as the Madison School District starts to take another look at its decision to have officers in high schools.
And we want to hear from you on this. Do you think that there should be a police officer in schools? Why or why not? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Have you or has a family member ever had involvement with a police officer at school, and what was that interaction like? Call us at 800-642-1234.
We'll go right to our callers. We've got Matt on the line in Fond du Lac. Matt, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you think?
Think of what?
Police officers in schools?
Oh, yeah. The police officers in schools that we deal with, I went to Madison Memorial in Madison, and we had a officer named Shannon Blackmore, and he was a really, really personal guy for one, and also just a true professional in how he handled situations, both in whether it be a big fight or a small bullying incident or like vandalism, like you guys mentioned before, handled it with grace each time and was able to handle it either taking it to the next level if really necessary, but also being able to defuse situations by himself. It's just one-on-one as well.
Matt, thanks a lot for the call. And Jason, I wonder, that points toward maybe the question isn't should we or shouldn't we have police officers in schools, but if we do, what should be the policy? Do we define their role and presence as much as we should?
Yeah, you know, I think I have two responses to that. So if we are going to have police officers in schools, and first of all, I do want to say that by no means am I saying, one, that police officers in schools are bad people, because I sincerely believe that the vast majority of police officers in schools and police officers generally are very good people, and I'm sure that they're acting in good faith much of the time. So if we are going to have police officers in schools, I would suggest two things. I would suggest, one, that we need to have a better training. And so we need to make sure the police officers are equipped to de-escalate situations, that they understand how to interact with students, for example, with learning disabilities or ADHD or autism, or to improve their ability to communicate with people who are different from them. That's extremely, extremely helpful. The second thing is that we need to make sure, if police officers do come in schools, that we have something in place called a Memorandum of Understanding, or an MOU. And this has been advocated, I think, by several different state governments as well as other government agencies. And essentially what a Memorandum of Understanding says is that it specifies when police officers are going to get involved and when they're going to stay out. And so, for example, some of these lower-level offenses, such as talking back to a teacher or refusing to give a cell phone, as we saw in South Carolina, those might be incidents that are better handled by teachers and administrators who receive more pedagogical training and are better equipped to handle those situations. Whereas if we have a situation that in which the other members of the school community, their safety might be in jeopardy, that may be a more appropriate place for the schools, school resource officers to become involved.
Matt, thanks a lot for calling. Before we go back to our callers at 800-642-1234, Jason, a lot of this, I think, might be fueled by the perception of a lack of safety at schools. We've had, of course, horrific school shootings over the years, a perception that schools, even without those mass shootings, are out of control or violent places in some districts. Is that a correct perception of the way schools are in the United States right now?
Yeah, I think that's a very acute comment that you made there, Rob. And I think that, so overall, we do know the schools are generally safe places, and that's been documented repeatedly. We also know that school crime is actually decreasing since around 1994. So I think that schools, for the most part, and that doesn't mean that there are not some dangerous schools, because I think that there are. But far and wide, I think that schools are generally safe places. What happens is when you have an incident like what happened at Columbine in the early parts of the 2000-2001 period, and then when you had what happened at Sandy Hook Elementary School in December of 2012, that puts a very heinous event in the, it makes it very high profile, and we as a people and sometimes the government, we tend to overreact to those situations. And school officers or school officials and educators are put in a very difficult spot. And the reason is that they sometimes need to demonstrate to the school community, to parents and others, that they are doing something tangible in order to create safer learning environments. And so one of the ways in which they can do that is to hire a school resource officer or to install metal detectors or some of these other surveillance methods in order to tangibly demonstrate that they're doing something to address the safety problem.
Talking to Jason Nance, law professor at the University of Florida, looking at police officers in schools. Should they be there? Shouldn't they? We'll go back to our callers with Elisa in Milwaukee. Elisa, hi.
Hi, this is Elisa. The purpose of my call is I'm wondering what is the logic behind having police officers? Why wouldn't it be off-duty officers hired as security guards? Or hired as safety people, Why the need to have this criminalization of the behavior from these students? Because they are in school, so we will call them students.
Gotcha, and, Lisa. Your line is not great, but I think we got your point there, Jason. She's saying, why official on-duty police officers if we want more security? Maybe some kind of security guard, hiring off-duty officers, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And first of all, Lisa, I think that we should say that there are some schools that utilize security guards that are police officers that are retired or are not sworn law enforcement officers at all. And so I think that that is something that's not certainly not uncommon. The reason why probably that schools want to have sworn law enforcement officers is because that these, first of all, the parents or the community members might demand that. I think that sometimes that the police agencies themselves may take a proactive approach, and they think that that's a good way to deter crime by having a, you know, sometimes crimes do occur on school campuses, and that's a way in which they can be proactive about it. The other thing is that they do have the authority to intervene in all different types of situations, and so they can arrest as a security guard could not. And I think that there are some parents and some school officials that would view that as a positive thing, even though we see some of those detrimental effects that occur to a student once they are arrested and if they are detained or incarcerated.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to Gordon in Wisconsin Rapids. Gordon, hi.
Hey, guys. Good afternoon. Say, I'm all for having law enforcement in schools, especially high school, with you know, high schools being a soft target for the heinous criminals that want to shoot things up just to get a name for themselves. You know, we just had a daughter graduate from Rapids Lincoln High School, and we know the local law enforcement folks, and they're great people, and we have no trouble at all having any of them in the school system. And we have a son going in being a sophomore and another son in middle school. Had four kids graduate already. And we want our kids to be safe, and it's what taxpayers want. Taxpayers want our the kids of the future, you know, to be safe at school.
Gordon, thanks for the call. So the community members, parents want officers in schools. So Jason, should school boards, whatever they see in the data, should they go along with their community?
You know, I think that there is sort of a general perception that perhaps that they are making schools safer. And as I said before, certainly school resource officers, many of them, perhaps most of them, do a good job. Again, if we are going to have those school resource officers in place, I think that there needs to be some type of either a memorandum of understanding or something else in place that specifies that they're not going to intervene in these lower level incidents. And so if that were to happen, I think that that's going to, I think that would help resolve a lot of these problems that we're seeing overall.
Jason, as we wrap up, you started by telling us some of the statistics. Seems like more officers. Do you see a tide turning? Do you see more districts reconsidering, maybe moving away from the approach of having officers in schools?
I think that that conversation is starting to take place, Rob. I think that now that there are more individuals that are discussing and talking about the school-to-prison pipeline. In fact, for the first time to my knowledge, that is part of the platform of the Democratic Party. Is they've put that into their platform of finding ways in which we can dismantle the school-to-prison pipeline. And so I think that overall, that is a trend, and that's something that we're thinking about. Now, there's different aspects of that school-to-prison pipeline. There's the suspensions and the expulsions part that people are addressing. But I think that we overall as a nation are starting to think very hard on alternative ways in which we can keep students safe rather than referring kids to law enforcement.
We'll leave it there. Jason, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Jason Nance. He's an associate professor of law and associate director of the Center on Children and Families at the University of Florida Levin College of Law.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.